Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. You're about to meet modern-day explorer, pioneer, and mentor Milbrey Polk. She traveled through Greece, Turkey, Persia, Pakistan, and Japan, surveyed Arthurian sites in Wales, hung out with Bedouin tribesmen in Jordan and Egypt, kayaked Alaska's Prince William Sound, all before graduating from Harvard in 1976. In 1979, she led a camel expedition retracing Alexander the Great's route across Egypt. She's also been to Nepal, Laos, Burma, and Tibet and the Arctic, just to name a few more out-of-the-way spots. The author of 10 books, Milbrey co-founded and was the executive director of Wings World Quest, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the support of women at the edge of science and discovery. She is a contributing editor of the Explorer's Journal and frequently lectures and serves on the boards of museums, theater, news, and arts organizations. Polk is a fellow of the Explorers Club, fellow of the Royal Geographic Society, and honorary fellow of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. In 2011, she received the Anne Morrow Lindbergh Award, given for outstanding individual achievement, just one of her numerous honors. And also, just by the way, Milbrey's great-great-great uncle was James Polk, the 11th President of the United States. Milbrey, welcome. And thanks for making the trip.
Thank you very
into
much.
Into Midtown Manhattan. I want to start at the beginning and ask you right out, where did your wanderlust come from?
It came from my family. Both of my grandmothers were intrepid travelers on freighters and every which way they could travel. My father is a great explorer himself. And so from a very early age, he took us camping, but not just camping. I mean, really camping. Rafting down the Colorado River, camping in deserts, whatever it was. So I've had it in
Your blood.
Yeah, definitely.
But your grandmothers, I mean, that in and of itself is crazy. You're probably one of a kind in this time, but considering your grandmothers.
They were just very curious about the world and very driven and loved meeting people in all kinds of circumstances. And one of my grandmothers wrote a wonderful book called Darling's All that my sister and I are now republishing with maps and photographs and other things, which because when she wrote it, that was more difficult to do.
So did they travel by themselves?
My grandmother often did. My mother's mother, my grandmother, my father's side, who wrote Darling's All, often traveled with her sister. And so that they would, and she was very naughty. So I know one time she was on the USS President Polk, and you know, our family is from the president. And they landed in Hong Kong, and the Hong Kong paper sent out a junior reporter to interview the widow of the president. And she proceeded to give an amazing interview about life in the White House, not bothering to tell him that
it wasn't her, right? She wasn't the Polk living in the White House.
But it was 100 years
prior.
Apart, uh-huh. Yes. So she would do things like that and write about them. And so she was a lot of fun. People really loved being with her and loved meeting her. And so she was, you know, I had this, growing up, I had all these people around me that were so inspiring.
And so it would have been almost aberrational if you didn't do what
right.
you do.
Well, many of my siblings don't particularly do this, but my family were very encouraging of everybody to follow their own path mm-hmm. in whatever it is. And so that's always been a very good thing. And that's one of the reasons I think that it's when I started Women of Discovery, it's so important to support people, whatever their particular path or passion is, and not try to tell them what they have to do, but
or discourage them for
right.
that matter.
Right.
Aside from your family, who was there to mentor you?
I was very, very lucky. When I was at Harvard, I'd been living in Egypt before I went to Harvard, and my godfather was an Egyptian architect named Hassan Fathi. And so he was an amazing role model, and we did a lot of traveling together when he showed me the villages that he built out of mud brick all around Egypt and other places. And along the way, I've had a very lucky time of meeting people. I worked, after I graduated from Harvard, one of my first jobs was with Margaret Mead. And so, you know, she was pretty amazing. I was scared to death of her, but she was pretty amazing.
Did you travel to the South Pacific to work with her?
No. It was at the Museum of Natural History.
Okay, well, that's okay. That's fine. Did you have reason to be afraid of her?
She was very formidable. And she was very smart and always two steps ahead of everybody. And I was only 21 years old. And she gave me a piece of advice which really changed the course of my life. After I graduated from Harvard, the one thing I really wanted to do was to go to Oxford and get my PhD. That was sort of the thing you did. And I was working towards all of that and just about to go and do all the applications and exams. And she took me aside and said, "Why on earth do you want to do that?" And I said, "Well, because I want to be an anthropologist." And she said, "Well, you already know what you want to do. And if you go to Oxford, yes, you'll get a degree and you'll do very, very well, but you'll come out in debt. And because you're a woman, they're going to assign you to some third-rate junior college somewhere. And all of the tribes you want to study have already been taken by somebody else. And so you're going to be stuck with something that you don't really want to do. And you'll be trapped." And I was just totally deflated. And I was thinking, what do I want to do? And what I really wanted to do was go retrace the route of Alexander the Great. She said, "Just go down to National Geographic and talk to them." So I did.
And they sponsored you, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. They're one of my sponsors on that trip.
That was in 1979. And you were how old?
I was 24.
24. Mm-hmm. And you were going to do this under their auspices. Mm-hmm. And so they financed your trip?
Partly. But they had... it was under their auspices that I could do it. I had to buy all the camels, and I had to.
Where does one buy a camel?
In the camel market.
Of course. Uh-huh. And who was accompanying you?
There were seven of us. My cousin and her husband, who were then living in Saudi Arabia, came. She was a medical technician, so I thought she could be the role of the doctor on the trip. And her husband had been a navigator in the Navy. And I figured, well, sand and water, you know, he can help out.
Yeah.
And we had a scientist from the Naval Medical Research Unit. And we had a friend of mine who was an architect. And then we had some Bedouin with us. And so we had 10 camels. And we retraced the route through the Qatar Depression, which is the deepest part of Africa. It was an amazing experience. And that led – I'd been on expeditions before of my own, but that led to – the next five or so years, I was just working as an itinerant journalist explorer.
Were you basically a photojournalist?
Yes.
But it was your idea to retrace Alexander the Great's steps.
Yes. He'd been my, since a very early age, Alexander was like, I thought there was nobody better that ever lived than him. I was just fascinated by everything he did, and the way he went about doing what he did was so interesting.
How long did that take you?
It was a lot of preparation, months and months and months of preparation. And then we had to go out to the Libyan border with the camels. And the walking itself took about a month. So it wasn't that long.
You know, you're saying it, and forgive me, not that you're saying it cavalierly, but you're saying it like you just went to the parking garage and got your car. I mean, you walked for a month with camels and people. It's, to me, nuts, although it seems like de rigueur to you.
You know, when you're in a situation, no matter what the situation is, it takes up everything. It's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And when it ends, it's sad. You know, you want to keep going.
Sure, sure. So you documented this journey, mm-hmm. which took how long, did you say?
Well, it was was a month. But then there was before and after, which is, they always say that when you're planning something like this, planning is about 90%. And that's fundraising, that's doing all the things you have to do. And then you do it, which is maybe 4%. Mm-hmm. And then you have all the follow-up, which can be huge, too.
What did National Geographic do with your information?
That's another story, but they were really quite wonderful. There was a publisher there was a man named Graves, and he was really quite wonderful. There were two camel women at that time, another woman that walked across Australia. And he was very supportive, and I worked on a couple of other expeditions after that. I think that they are always looking for something dramatic to happen. And much later when I was working with Wings and after this book came out, Women of Discovery, a couple of different television shows approached me to do segments on some of these women. But then they said they had to be blonde and beautiful and doing something incredibly dangerous.
Oh, come
on. And so—
What year was this?
This was in 2004.
When your book, Women of Discovery?
It came out in 2001. So in that period afterwards, when we were trying to do a TV show, and I realized that, you know, people have a different understanding of what exploration is. When you see these survival TV shows, and that's not exploration. That's sort of like, I think it's stunts or extreme sports.
Mm-hmm.
But exploration is really about learning where you are and mm-hmm. and seeing things maybe in a different way, and then taking that information and then sharing it with other people when you come back. And hopefully if it's something, like what I was doing was more of an adventure, but there are other people that I've been working with that whose discoveries really help us understand the world in a better way. And so it's really important that we listen to what they have to tell us so that we can make the right decisions going forward about whatever it is.
It's about knowledge, isn't
yeah.
it?
Mm-hmm.
And amassing knowledge.
Right.
That's how we learn.
Right, right.
Was that a seminal moment in your life, the Alexander
yeah.
the Great
mm-hmm.
expedition, so to speak?
I gave up going to graduate school, and I just started working. In those days, you know, it's interesting how much the world has changed, because then if you could write and you could take photographs, you could get assignments. Today, nobody wants to publish books anymore, and everybody has a camera that takes amazing pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two things that I was really doing with my life, I can't do anymore. I mean, I could, but it's very, very difficult. But then it was, I mean, I was in Yemen, I was in Jordan, I did a book in Saudi Arabia. I was traveling everywhere. And today you really can't go to a lot of these places, especially being an American and maybe even being a woman. It's really tough. But then everybody wanted to help me. It was lovely. It was really, really, it was a very special time.
And wanted to help you in spite of the fact that you are a woman?
Mm-hmm. Especially, I remember I spent a lot of time with the Bedouin in Egypt and Jordan and other places. And when I would come into an encampment, I didn't know if I should go to the women's side or
mm-hmm.
the men's side. It was a very, because once I went into one, it was sort of hard to go into the other. I usually went into the men's side because that's where whoever I was with was translating. But I was always wanted to go into the women's side. I would eventually, because they were very curious about me too. And but there were very different kinds of things that were going on in a very small space.
But were you treated as an anomaly? The Bedouin men must have thought that of you.
Well, they didn't know. They didn't quite know what to
do with you or think of you. Yeah.
And other women that I have subsequently met, that Western women that spent time in those cultures, also had different. People didn't know, and I had a camera, and a camera was kind of like an object that made me distant from everybody, and I could use that to
mm-hmm.
kind of capture what I was seeing.
And that was when?
70s and early 80s.
And now here we are, you know, all these years later, and in a way, it's even more restrictive, right?
Right. You're absolutely right. I have three daughters who are in their 20s, who are the ages now that I was when I was going around the world, and you know, it's a little scary now to think about going some places because it's not the same world that it was. Television and movies. I remember when I was in northern Burma, in a very remote area, in the mid 80s, and children were coming out of their houses screaming "Rambo, Rambo!" and making signs of machine guns, and I thought that's very strange. But then I realized that they had seen posters of
Sylvester Stallone
being
mm-hmm.
Rambo.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, that meant American. So they were saying Rambo like high American.
Right.
And
right.
And that kind of change was catastrophic. You know, it just really, we don't realize the power of the images that we have unleashed on the world in terms of films.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working in Saudi Arabia in the 1980s, the TV show Dallas was then very prominent. And I remember everywhere I went, because I was doing a book for the Ministry of Transportation, all the young men that spoke English would say, "Are you from Texas?" And part of my family is from Texas. And I would say, "Well, yes, my family's from Fort Worth." They went, "Oh." and they would start treating me differently, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And then I realized they were watching reruns of Dallas.
Is that nuts?
And so they thought all American women were like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they shot people, they slept with people, they drank. But that was the impression that we were sending abroad of American women, which was just, when I realized this, it was very shocking. Of course, these young men didn't really know anything else. This is what they were seeing.
Sure.
And of course, they realized it was a TV show, but still it portrays something. And so, you know, we've done a lot of this to ourselves.
But I kind of can't let go of the fact that it was so much more liberating for you
mm-hmm.
back then could you sit here today and tell me, well, when I was trekking across Saudi Arabia in 2012 or
no, it'd be entirely different.
You can't.
You can't. There are a lot of things you just can't. Or Yemen. We didn't have terrorism then the way we have it now. We didn't have a lot of these things. I remember being in Egypt in the 60s when I was young, and the Russians were the sort of the predominant power then. And it was just the loveliest, loveliest country. Everybody was thrilled to meet an American, thrilled to help you in any way that they could, inviting you into their homes, their shops for tea, to talk. And I was there with my father, who speaks Arabic, classical Arabic, quite fluently, and he would get into poetry duels with people in tea shops. And it was just a lovely, different experience than it is now. And, of course, you also have to remember that our world population is now, you know, grown exponentially mm-hmm. since that time. And so that all the resultant pressures for jobs, food, land, everything has increased. And I think the stress level on the human population worldwide is pretty strong. Because a lot of the women that I work with now are working in different areas, whether they work with animals or oceans or whatever, and they can see the stress levels on our whole environment are just staggering right now. And we don't, when we live in New York or live in places like this, we don't see it and we don't feel it. But I tell you, going to the Arctic and other places, you can see it. And we're going to be hit, I think, about food and water before too long.
Do you feel helpless?
No, I never feel helpless. I feel very hopeful. And I feel hopeful because there's so many people out there that are really trying to understand the situation and come up with solutions. And if anything else today, we have, through thanks to the internet and the knowledge and sharing knowledge, we have the possibility of really reveling in the mysterious of the world, which is all around us, and we lose touch to that, but mm-hmm. it's all around us. And that's very exciting. But I do think we have to address some very serious problems that we have, and we don't right now.
And why do you think that is?
I think partly it's what I said, that we don't see it, because we go along in our lives day to day, and the changes that are happening are either very small or they can be large, like a hurricane or something horrible happens, the Sandy, the once in a century,
sure.
whatever. But then it's over and we forgot because we've moved on to the next whatever.
And it's not often that you get so directly impacted by something.
Right. But even if you do, the way that our lives work, you just move on. And I think it's very important always to go back and look at history and look at the things that have happened and what's happened since then so that we understand a flow of consequences rather than just looking at things like bullets, which is what mm-hmm. we sort of do now.
Before we get into your books, I want you to talk about Wings World Quest, this organization that you founded. First of all, what's the significance of the name?
Wings doesn't stand for anything. It just means giving people a lift.
Mm-hmm.
And the name Wings had been taken by aviation companies and luggage companies. And so we had to think of, well, what is it they're doing? They're going in the world on a quest. So that's what Wings World Quest.
And why did you start this organization?
Well, very, very briefly, after I was working out in the field a lot for many years, then I had children, and I had to think, what can I do now that's different? And somebody suggested that I look at women explorers, and I thought, I don't think there are that many.
That won't take long.
And so I started, she actually gave me a couple of clues, and I started a little organization with my friend Leela Hadley-Luce that our purpose was to record oral histories. And I wanted to find elderly women that had done something amazing and then help them place their archives. And I worked with five women. And it was just so fascinating to me. And I couldn't believe I didn't know about these women and what they had done with their lives, which was amazing. And CBS Sunday Morning followed me on one of the tracks to meet one of the women that everybody that had heard about her said, oh, she's dead. She wasn't dead. She was living in a retirement home in Florida. And it made me realize that when women get old, they get lost in a way that men don't. And especially historically, women explorers, many of them never got married because they had to choose. Today, that's not the case, thank God. They can choose to however they want to arrange their domestic life, but they can have a partner.
Mm-hmm. They can have it all.
Well,
sort
they
of.
Can try.
Yeah, okay, sort of, right.
but a lot of these older women couldn't. And I remember one in particular was Helen Foster Snow, whose husband, Edgar Snow, we all know because he was with Mao on the Long March. But Helen, of course, did something much more extraordinary than Edgar. She walked alone across China through the Japanese lines to get to the first Chinese Congress that was being held in the caves in Yunnan. And she dressed as a peasant, and she was a very beautiful, Hollywood beautiful type woman. And she did all the interviews, and she rolled them up into little balls and stitched them inside of her padded jacket and walked back. And the only thing she carried with her was a very elegant dress and stockings and high heels, because she washed herself in a ditch, put on this dress and her hat, and then walked right through the Japanese guards and got on a train. And they were so shocked to see this blonde Western woman that appeared out of nowhere in the middle of nothing that they let her get on the train. And then she went on to write quite a number of books. And she told me that her greatest mistake was that Good Housekeeping magazine asked her to write an article. And she said she felt that her work was too important and intellectual to go to a Good Housekeeping magazine. But then when she came back to America in the end of the 40s, early 50s, right into the heart of McCarthyism, she realized if she had written that article, people would know who she was. But then she was just branded as a communist, which
wow.
she wasn't.
Wow.
And she and her husband divorced her and whatever. So she was living in a tiny, tiny little ancient cabin in Madison, Connecticut. And she spent all of her little Social Security checks, which were very small, on photocopying her writings, which she wrote many books and did a lot of writing, and would send them to people trying to go
published.
Somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They were published, but trying to do something with them. And it just never, ever happened for her. And she ate cat food. And I mean, it was just staggering to me that this amazing person could end like this. And so I finally found some people, and we got all of her archives into the University of Utah, where she'd been from. So, because otherwise, I'm sure that when she died, it would have been
all faded away. So she was
one of the five.
The initial five.
Right. And then I realized that there was a much larger story that wasn't being told. And so Leela and I founded Wings World Quest, and we decided that what we wanted to do was to seek out and people today that are doing really stellar things, women, and then give them an award, make them Wings Fellows. And then with that money, we had no stipulation on it, but it was $10,000, which no other organization like ours gave that kind of money at all. So we wanted to make a statement.
Where'd the money come from?
We had galas once a year that we raised the money, and then I did a lot of fundraising. And then we would create educational programs out of their stories. And I had one that I ran with a friend of mine in Texas. She had an organization called Imagination Celebration. And together we created the Art of Exploration. We had it in the public schools in Fort Worth. And so thousands and thousands of kids came through that program. They met amazing women. They got inspired. And many of them have gone on to be really interested in science, boys and girls. And we did programs a lot of places like that. And I was writing. So I wanted to take these examples of women. And they didn't have to, some of them didn't even have high school degrees. Some of them were, youngest I think that we gave an award to was 23, and the oldest one was 94.
Wow.
And the 94-year-old was just an incredible woman who lived in the walls of Antibes in France. She was Swedish, and she'd always lived her life very frugally, but she'd published a lot of books of her photographs. And she'd been forgotten, totally forgotten. And so when we gave her this award and she came to New York and she said she'd never had so much money in any one place in her life.
Wow.
And then the wonderful thing is that the government of Sweden found out about this and they realized that, oh, my goodness, here's this treasure. And they declared her a national treasure. They acquired all of her photographs, which are otherwise who knows what would happen to them. They're now in the museum in Stockholm. And they made a very long videotape about her life.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and she died at the end of that year. But she said before she died, she told me that she died happy because it all came together. And everything she did, she now knew people would see and pay attention. And her life had value and meaning.
As opposed to just scrambling, just kind of yelling in the forest and nobody hears you. And you and your organization was a savior.
Well, we have almost 70 fellows now. And we're going to have, we had a two-year hiatus. I left to go run a security conference, which is touched on a lot of these issues that, you know, food, water, terrorism, all the issues of how do we live in a more secure world. And so then I've come back recently now to run Wings again. And then for the first time, if I can raise the money, we're going to have a forum that we bring all these women or as many as we can together in one place because they're all over the world. And most of them work in isolation, and they don't. So bringing them together to have a forum, which we'll tape, like little TED Talk kind of thing, and then they'll have time to be together, just to privately to be together, because they have a lot of things that they have to, you know, they've experienced a lot of things. And finding somebody else that understands what you're talking about is invaluable.
How did you come to do Women of Discovery?
Well, I realized that if I was going to do something about women, I had to have a book, because a book is like your calling card. And I also, because I was working with modern women, I began reading a lot about the history. And I was thinking, why aren't all these women in the books that you read? Because I'm a book reviewer, sorry, and about exploration. And I just never came across any women. I'm in the middle of a book now on Arctic women explorers. There's so many books about explorers of the Arctic, none about the women that were there. But the first photography in the Arctic was a woman, first filmmaker in the Arctic was a woman, the first person that used radar was a woman in the Arctic making underwater maps.
Why?
I don't know. And the one wonderful thing about women is that they always wrote everything. They're very prolific, because that's the way to prove that you did what you did. And I was buying some books from a book dealer once, and he said, well, these must be very valuable. They're all first editions. And I said, there were only first editions.
Right.
And there are people, and I just don't, I'm grappling to try to understand why it is that women are left out of the story. There was just something I read recently on the internet, on the Scientific American blog, celebrating Edward Jenner and the smallpox vaccine. Smallpox vaccine was discovered by Lady Mary Wortley Montagu 150 years before Jenner. And she almost lost her life for it because she was called a witch from the pulpit in England. She discovered it because her husband was named ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. And she was a lady and related to the royal family. And she announced that she was going to go with him. But not only was she going to go with him, but she was going to go separately in her own carriage and see things along the way and write letters, which was just not done then. And when she got to Turkey, she went all around the countryside and saw that people, smallpox then was a horrible disease that disfigured you. And she noticed that people would scratch their skins and they would put cowpox and ground up into these little scratches. And she studied it quite a bit. And she had her own children inoculated. And she came back to England with this very exciting discovery and told the king. And he had a trial done with prisoners. He had some prisoners inoculated and then put them into cells with people that were dying of smallpox. And they didn't get the smallpox.
Huh.
So he ended up having people in his family inoculated. And that was when she was denounced from the pulpit for being a witch and consorting with the devil. But she wrote about it. She wrote books about it. And so when I wrote a little thing to Scientific America saying, please give.
Right. Please, oh, by the way.
But this story is repeated over and over and over again in almost every arena. And when I was reading the history, I was very intrigued to find that in the 19th century in America and England particularly, botany was allowed to be something that women could do because it was a nice science. It was dealing with plants. But women couldn't go to university, so they were never botanists, like scientists.
Mm-hmm.
They were botanizers.
Oh, come on.
And so they could never be published. And so many of them had to have their work published under a different name or under their male colleague's name. Some of that still exists today. It's not over, but it was very difficult then. And so really the only thing they could do is if they could publish their own book privately, something that showed what they did. And the more I began reading, and I have a collection of over 1,000 books that were written about by women were about women explorers from the last, say, 400 years. And there are many, many more. I just haven't been able to track them all down, especially in places that are more difficult for me to get to. Or
I can't imagine what places are difficult to get to that you haven't been.
Well, I can't read Arabic, and I can't mm-hmm. read – I don't read Spanish very well, and I mm-hmm. can't read French or German. But these women certainly existed in all those cultures because exploration is part of us. Everybody, every human being has in our DNA, as they're now unraveling all these mysteries of the past, we all walked out of Africa together. We all walked, men and women, together all around the world. And it was this impulsive quest to see the world that took humans everywhere. You don't see gorillas didn't go all around the world. Other animals didn't. Humans did. And it's in we're curious. We're innately curious. And I think that that's something that if we look at each other together, men and women, as humans doing something, it's different. But for some reason, we have this difference of men and women, there's lots of reasons we have it now. It's codified in law and everything else, but we have to get to a point where we can equally look and value the contributions of women as well as men.
Do you see this as an uphill battle?
It's a tough battle, and I think if you speak to women that are out there in the field in their particular area, it's a very uphill battle.
So do you feel buoyed or do you feel deflated?
Oh, I feel buoyed. I feel buoyed that there's so many amazing women that are so passionate and care so much about whatever their particular area of study is that they're willing to give up a lot of things to do what they do. And the one wonderful byproduct of Wings is I didn't go to graduate school, but it has been my graduate school, because to be able to talk to a lot of these women, I have to understand what they do and what they've done and what they've discovered. So it's like mini courses all the time.
Do you feel encouraged for your daughters?
Very much so. They do different things than mm-hmm. I did. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it well. They're struggling. It's not easy. It's not easy being young now in general. But I think often we forget that it's not always so easy for women. One example, and I don't really understand why this is, but if you read in stories in like Discovery magazine or in any magazines about, say you read about Lucy, the Australopithecine, always when you read about that, they mention Donald Johanson, who found or led the team that found Lucy. But if you read about dark matter, you don't see the name Vera Rubin, who have found the proof for dark matter. You read about dark matter. And you may need to read about other scientists that are involved because it's a big study. So somehow, unconsciously, we don't couple the name of the woman the way we couple the name of the man who is a discoverer,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which I think is a very interesting thing. I don't think it's something that is done consciously at all. I think it's just the way it's done. And so we don't reinforce the contributions that women have made so easily.
What's next for you?
Well, I would like to expand Wings. I would like to make our forums a yearly thing. I would like to expand the educational aspect of what we do, because I think that there's a huge role in inspiring younger people to go into the sciences, not just women. It's important for women, too, but we are facing so many challenges now in the world that we really need to have people, a lot of people that are scientifically literate, that they can understand. They may not have to be scientists, but they can understand and evaluate and make the right kinds of decisions, both personally and then in their local or state politics or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And that is really a huge uphill battle that we face in the United States. It's shocking, I think, to see how far down the ladder the United States is in terms of educational excellence compared to other countries, when we have so much here that we really shouldn't be in that state.
Yeah, I have to beat the drum for this.
But the way to do it is to show them these amazing people and what they've done and how interesting what they're doing is.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's about discovering your own passion. That's number one.
And acting on it.
And acting on it. And it doesn't have to be a big thing. Like, you don't have to be an astronaut.
You don't have to retrace Alexander the Great's
no.
steps.
Uh-huh. No, you can do – it can be small things. And I there's one example that I love that I used to do a lot of lecturing in, like, women's clubs and things like that. And I was in one, talking about the history of women explorers, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you know, that's great, really interesting, but, you know, it's not related to me at all. It's something I can relate to. I can't live like that. And I said, well, what do you like to do? And she was sort of taken aback, and she said, well, I shop. And I said, well, if you couldn't shop, if the stores are closed, what do you like to do? What do you really like to do? And she had to think a minute, and then she said, well, it's sort of strange, but I like to make pies. And I said, that's great. Do you go to church? And she said, of course I go to church. And so I said, well, is there a soup kitchen? Well, she had no idea. And so I said, well, see if there's a soup kitchen, then take your pies down there, and then who knows? She said, thank you, and walked off. And a couple months later, I got a note from her saying there was a soup kitchen. She took her pies, and she'd met the most interesting people. They'd come from all over the world. She had no idea that people in Dallas were so hungry, and she was loving her Saturdays.
And it wasn't rocket science.
No, it was just, you know, but it was me giving her permission. It's okay to make pies.
And validating her,
yeah,
too.
Right. And then when somebody does that, no matter what it is, I you can knit, you can, I don't know, whatever it is that makes you feel that your life is validated, then you act on it. And then it can take you places you will never dream of. But you have to trust that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that by hearing other people's stories, you can get a little bit of that trust and excitement back for yourself.
Wow. How great was it to meet you and have a conversation with you, Milbrey Polk. You're very inspiring in a very laid-back kind of way. It was my pleasure to meet you, and I can't believe we've kind of run out of time, but I could do this a lot longer.
Well, thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at the 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.